Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Derek Davis, and we're going to continue the exploration of the cultures of consciousness. When I was a relatively wee lad in college, which now seems like a wee lad part of my life, though at the time I felt like a big boy, I had this sort of curious experience of being thrust deep into the bubbling pool of deconstruction and so-called critical theory. So I went from a high school where the big thinkers were sort of, you know, William Blake and Hunter S. Thompson and H.P. Lovecraft, J.R.R. Tolkien. Those were my heroes, maybe a little bit of Sartre, a little bit of philosophy in there, to the sort of hotbed of deconstructive critical theory. And that was, you know, needless to say, a fascinating and overwhelming and in some ways kind of airless and infuriating world. And there was a lifeline in the guise of philosophy. And this was the work of the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze. And today we'll be talking about Deleuze with one of his many necessary explicators, Joshua Ramey, who has the wonderful distinction of also seeing how the work of Deleuze, which is a solid, if somewhat esoteric dimension of the current philosophical landscape, but how Deleuze plays into some of the esoteric and metaphysical and hermetic magical ideas that we play with on this show, and that indeed we insist is sort of part of our contemporary landscape and needs to be affirmed as such. But for me, even before I could really understand the stuff, which I'm still not sure I could say that I do, he's sort of a notoriously complicated thinker, a thinker of complexity in many ways, and yet I could recognize that there was something vibrant, something animating these texts, particularly this monster book called A Thousand Plateaus that he wrote with his pal, the renegade psychiatrist Félix Guattari. And this book is very peculiar. At the very beginning it says, this book is very peculiar, but use it like you would listen to a record. You know, you find those songs you like, you find the parts of the songs that make you vibrate, and just go with those. And I took that advice, and so I kind of skipped the stuff I didn't understand, and I focused on the things I did really grok. And there were a lot of very interesting elements there, a kind of weird shamanistic undertow. There was discussions of becoming sorcerer. There was a kind of description of the nomad as this sort of this kind of mystical metallurgist of matter. There was a whole chapter devoted to the peculiar concept of the body without organs, which I'll just leave as a weird sounding concept for now. Maybe we'll get to it in our discussion, but in this chapter they talk about how to construct a body without organs, which you, in reading more deeply, they were talking about Taoism, they were talking about Carlos Castaneda, they were talking about psychedelics, and it was clear that they were describing a kind of thinking that was also a kind of experience or a kind of probe of experience, and particularly kinds of experiences that I could recognize from my own interest in the sort of outlier realms of human consciousness and altered states. And so there was a sort of magic, a glowing lifeline of shamanic weirdness that lay in these texts, which then became really important way for me to navigate through the whole realm of critical theory. And they're texts that I keep going back to on again, off again throughout my life, finding new things, new threads. It's still a kind of a conundrum to me, and I look forward to talking with Joshua about his particularly hermetic and esoteric spin on Deleuze, which really helps explain for me why I was always so attracted to this work. But before we get to that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daoud. Maja, do you have a favorite Western philosopher?
Oh, man. Well, I can tell you with Deleuze, I got a little annoyed with him. I hope the guest doesn't mind. But because I found out about him, I was reading about Karl Popper a lot because I was studying science. So I was reading about Karl Popper's, like, negating stuff and getting into, like, prove you can only prove that things are wrong. And then I found out about his difference theory, you know, how everything is different than everything else and it goes all the way down to the bottom. And, you know, I'm a big fan of, like, Kant and Spinoza is awesome, too. I like him a lot. And so I was reading a lot of Deleuze's stuff about that, and I just would get so irritated because it seemed like he would only go one direction. And, I mean, for me, the thing with Hermeticism, which is why I'm really interested to talk to the guest today, is that you got to go, like, both ways, like, show how, and I think Deleuze did have that monist, like, kind of thing that joins everything, but it was so, like, he wouldn't just, like, state it. It was very, like, circular to me.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting you raise that because that's actually one of the big debates in Deleuze is whether there's a secret unity lurking there.
And well, I think to me there was, but he was just wouldn't say it.
Well, that's what his detractors say. And his defenders are often trying to say, no, it's still difference. It's still difference.
Right.
Which from an esoteric perspective, like you're talking about, you're like, well, can it be both? You know, do we really have to get so worried about the idea that on some level everything is a sort of unified, resonating oneness? Is that really so horrible? But we'll get to this because this is all really like core issues. But I love the fact that you had that response to it. It's like it's very, very insightful. So,
yeah.
With that, we'll bring on Joshua Ramey, professor of philosophy. Welcome to Expanding Mind.
Good to be here.
Hey, man. So I want to hear a little bit about your personal discovery of Deleuze. I presume you're already interested in philosophy, but I'm really kind of interested in like what was it in those writings, you know, both concepts and other sort of less conceptual aspects that drew you to focus so much of your career so far on his work?
Yeah, sure. Well, like you, Eric, I found something arid as well about the French scene of, you know, the post-war and then post-1968 era. And even though I was really attracted to the depth of the critical insight of people like, you know, Derrida and Lacan, Julia Kristeva, and others that I was exposed to by my mentors in college, it left me feeling unsatisfied. There was something I was still looking for, and it actually wasn't until I took a couple of years off after college. And it wasn't until I actually had decided to go to grad school already that I discovered Deleuze. And I don't even remember exactly how or why I started reading him, but I know that I did, and it really was as if a light had been turned back on, or maybe on for the first time, and something else started opening up, and that was the beginning of a kind of 10-year apprenticeship. I would say that you know, basically started around the year 2000, and you know, in some ways it's still going on, but I guess I've left my initial monument to it in the form of the book.
So you know, there's so many ways into this guy, and I really want to keep this conversation accessible as well as esoteric.
Sure.
And there's so many, and one of the things about reading his work that can be very exciting, especially the work with Guattari, is that he comes up with all these really wonderful sounding concepts, almost like science fictional, you know, magical terms: body without organs, the rhizome, the nomad, you know, the refrain. There's all these weird kinds of concepts that are almost more like fables or allegories. So there's so many ways into his stuff, and
yeah.
We talked a little bit beforehand about, you know, a good kind of launching point, and I think it's sort of the idea of immanence is a good place to start.
Sure. Well, you know, a good way into immanence is actually through the idea of the body without organs, and, you know, my book starts out with a eulogy that Jacques Derrida wrote for Deleuze, and they were friends, And Derrida said that if he could, this was, you know, just after Deleuze had died, you know, Derrida said that he could, that the two things he would have wanted to ask Deleuze about were his relation to Artaud and this conception of the body without organs that Antonin Artaud first sort of introduced as a kind of poetic, theatrical idea that Deleuze was very taken with. Derrida said, I'd like to ask him about that, and I would also like to ask him more about this idea of immanence, that Deleuze keeps saying this word, you know, and, you know, I talk about the way immanence is a kind of almost like a mantra in Deleuze's work, something he keeps repeating. But the idea of immanence for Deleuze is really about the idea that although there are different levels of being, there's ultimately a way that all the different levels traverse one another constantly, and there seem to be intensities, as he called them, that cross those different modalities, cross different kinds of organisms, even cross events that are remote in time and space, and that somehow the mind, or at least a certain usage of mind that we can talk more about, that I think, frankly, is ultimately a kind of esoteric usage of mind, can actually sort of delve into this plane of immanence. And, you know, one of the things that Deleuze said about himself once in an interview is that he said, I feel that I am a pure metaphysician. And this is what's interesting about Deleuze in relation to some of the other postmodern and so-called, you know, post-structuralist thinkers in France, is that, you know, Deleuze isn't critical of metaphysics. He's not critical of trying to say something about ultimate reality, you know, as opposed to somebody like Derrida, who, you know, is teaching us to be suspicious of language and, you know, to sort of flee the violence of the sign and signification, or to at least, you know, be very vigilant about it. You know, you talk about the science fiction, fictional aspect of the names of Deleuze's concept. I think Deleuze had a much more playful sense of what language can do, and that he was really inspired by what people like Artaud was doing, for instance, with those words, you know, the body without organs. You know,
well,
what is
one
that?
One way of saying that, I think, is that he was aware and conscious of how philosophy could be seen as not like art exactly, but corresponded to art in the sense that it created something.
Well, it's experimental for him.
And you know, build linguistic structures. It created concepts in a way that's almost like an artist crafting a new image.
Sure, yeah. And the image that Artaud was after with this body without organs that Deleuze takes up as immanence is this idea that we don't have to work with the given, with what's apparently given to us, to really be working with reality. In fact, we have to, in some sense, transgress the given to access the real. And immanence for Deleuze really is just something like ultimate reality. And the reason why this idea of accessing a body without organs is important is because it really is about self-transformation. It really, if thinking immanence is something like accessing a light body or a numinous body or an energetic body that in some sense subtends and in some sense exceeds the normal body or the body with organs, then thinking as an approach to immanence involves a kind of self-transformation. It involves what I call an ordeal, a spiritual ordeal.
Well, and would you say, too, that it involves a disintegration of differentiation for him? Just because, like, the idea of a body that it contains all these separate parts, like organs, when you have a body with no organs, you no longer have separations inside, and that's how you get to the immanence, right?
It can be, but I one of the things that I try to argue in the book is that the concept of difference and differentiation in Deleuze really has been misunderstood, that it's really more about intensities and differences in intensity rather than something like difference in the ordinary sense. So, for instance, when you do arrive at, in some sense, and you do experimentally arrive in some ways at least temporarily at the body without organs, you don't have a completely blank field or a completely indiscernible, nebulous kind of space. You have differences in intensity. In fact, you have what Deleuze calls extreme speeds and slownesses. It's not that there are no longer differences, it's that the differences are no longer the kinds of differences that are identifiable by our normal modes of perception and affect and thought.
They're not measurable.
Well, that's part of it. That's a big part of it, is that they're no longer measurable. That's
or you
right.
can think about it as a chaos. What I think of in the chapter on the body without organs, which he always stresses, is something that is produced and can be produced through practices as well as ways of thinking. And he talks about different sort of heretical ways of creating, of constructing this, of building it in your experience. And it really reminds me of a basic element of Taoist meditation, because the Taoists have a similar kind of image of this. So there's a sort of story about the creation of the world, starting off with this sort of Mr. Wonton, basically, it's just this perfect egg, and then who's associated with chaos, and then another fellow comes along and they bores 9 holes in him, and then chaos dies. And it's the idea, and then this gets replicated in Taoist practice, where part of what's happening, of course, it's very complicated, all the elements of meditation in Taoism, but one sort of basic motif is that in meditation, you sort of return to the primordial soup, the chaos of productive possibility that's, in a sense, dismantling your organization, that moment that Maj is talking about. But rather than finding yourself on a like divine ground of absolute, indistinguishable oneness, instead it's returning to a kind of plenum of potential, of all these sort of possible movements, that out of which then the sort of one is reconstructed again. And there's, it's a different process, but it seems to me that's one way of kind of thinking about it, is not a return to a single thing, but rather to return to a kind of exploding chaotic potential.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way into it. I like to use the word sometimes of repotentiation, that the movement is toward a zone of ultimate or radical repotentiation, and that does have to be approached carefully and through various practices that have traditions, and have traditions like Taoism, among others. That's right. And that's another thing that will come as a little bit of a contentious point, I think, out of my book for at least most Deleuzians, I think, is I think that, Deleuze's thought, which seems to emphasize a radical novelty and sort of the unforeseeable and experience, is actually about the repotentiation of traditions of practice, traditions of spiritual ordeal that have actually been with us for a very long time. So as with the concept of difference, I think that the emphasis on novelty and experimentation have been too often understood in Deleuze as sort of breaks with the absolute breaks with the past, absolute breaks with with what's come before, and I don't think that's what Deleuze is up to. I think what he's...
Well, I'm glad you're doing that too, because I'd say that one thing about sort of critical thought, from the sort of 70s, 80s, or 90s, is that there was this really strong emphasis on transgression, on the idea of like undermining the norm and finding the novel and decontextualizing, and almost this kind of violence of pulling out of any sort of more traditional rhythm. And in some sense it made a lot of sense, but then it became a lot of almost kind of corny, and Zizek would come in and make the good point that like these people, they're talking about transgression and sort of creating some kind of freedom, but if you actually look at the sort of transgressive practices that a lot of these people embrace as a manifestation of this movement, you find that of course they have their own rule sets, and in fact, and sometimes they're even more rigid than the worlds that they're turning away from. So there was a kind of naive celebration of transgression that came back, and I think Deleuze was often seen in that light. And yet, a lot of the resonances that you're talking about, and that I was also interested in, seem to point to something a little bit more complicated and nuanced. But talk about some of the traditions that you see this otherwise very innovative, almost, you know, in many ways transgressive kind of thinker, at least in terms of how philosophy is normally performed.
Sure.
But how does that link up with some more traditional frameworks that you're revealing in the book?
Well, sure. I mean, to put it laconically and paradoxically, right, I mean, there is a tradition of transgressive practice, right? I mean, this is part of what's at stake here, is that, you know, but Bataille is not the first person to think of, you know, simulating animal sacrifice as a way of, as a way of enlightenment or you know, sort of spiritual realization. You know, where I go to in particular is to the moment right before the birth of sort of modern philosophy with Descartes, which is the sort of the very strange and cryptic world of Renaissance Hermeticism, Renaissance philosophy, Renaissance Neoplatonism, and Renaissance Humanism, which is this another sort of strange amalgamation. But the thing about this period, and the reason I seized on it, was because I thought that reading some of these figures that I sort of stumbled onto by myself, I was sort of turned on to them by my mentor in college, who was a Renaissance studies person. She was a John Donne scholar, so I sort of learned about Renaissance Italian philosophy by way of the English poets, like, you know, John Donne and so on. But at any rate, these philosophers took magic very seriously. There was no sort of Cartesian mind-body split going on yet of the sort that would be able to write off the influence of the mental on the physical and vice versa as just something imaginary or something, you know, of a fantasy. So thinkers like Giordano Bruno and Pico della Mirandola, you know, had, you know, basically extensive treatments of esoteric practice, divination, magic of various sorts, as, you know, part and parcel of, you know, what just went under the name philosophy at the time. And like you said about A Thousand Plateaus, it's pretty amazing that a contemporary philosopher who knows as much about science, for instance, as Deleuze clearly did, you know, is basically giving us something like a kind of philosophical grimoire in A Thousand Plateaus.
That's a question that I have. Like, did you come across anything in your research that alluded to any specific practice that Deleuze did?
Deleuze himself?
Yeah.
That's a really interesting question, because the short answer is no. If you read Deleuze's biography, there's a couple things. In the first case, we know that Deleuze, when he was fairly young, was hanging around with some people during the World War II in particular. There were these salons going on at the home of this woman named Madeleine Davy, who was a French medievalist who was also very interested in the Hermetic tradition. Had people who were Martinists and so on, who were hanging around in her circle. But Deleuze's philosophical talents were recognized that when he was very young, he was invited to these salons where, you know, conversations not only about philosophy but about esotericism generally were going on. And of course, you know, this is the 1940s, so, you know, you have to think about the occult revival in Europe in the beginning of the 20th century and things like this as well. And Deleuze wrote some articles at a very young age. One of them is one I talk about a lot called Mathesis, Science, and Philosophy. And there are several others, but they refer to esoteric practices, but it's not at all clear that Deleuze engaged in any kind of meditational practice, or, you know, if he did psychedelics or anything like this. I mean, as far as what he did and in his own life, I haven't found any evidence one way or another. I just know that, in particular, in his younger writings, he's extremely explicit about being interested in things like, for instance, 19th century esoteric medicine as practiced by Johann Malfatti, who was this kind of crazy Italian doctor and esotericist who treated Beethoven, actually. And Deleuze is very interested in this idea of mathesis, which is an ultimate integration of science and metaphysics, science and religion, that would be a kind of ultimate healing art. And this is really where I start my explication of Deleuze as a kind of contemporary hermeticist, because I argue that these early interests are there in a subterranean way all throughout the work, and actually come back out even stronger when he gets in connection with Guattari, who's interested in this kind of radical possibility of healing and transformation.
Well, and he gets really sick for like the last 25 years of his life, right? He had some kind of like heart and lung thing happening. So, I mean, that's why I'm wondering, like, what was he doing? I mean, everyone talks about these philosophers and kind of their thoughts, but if you're thinking about a body without organs, I mean, this man had one of his lungs removed, right?
Yeah. He was suffering tremendously. It's interesting to watch the L'Abécédaire de Gilles Deleuze, which is this series of TV interviews he gave that has now, you know, been released in a beautiful edition. With wonderful English subtitles. You can watch several hours of him speaking. You can see that with every breath he takes, he's in tremendous pain. Every breath is absolutely painful for him. And, you know, I mean, depending on what spiritual tradition you're in, I mean, living with that kind of pain and breathing through it and living through it and working through it day after day is, you know, a spiritual ordeal, if I ever heard of one. You know, who knows how just the act of having to cope with pain and to find a point of awareness or a point of consciousness through which to think from out of that pain, I mean, that's, you know, in many ways, that's a kind of yoga, right? I mean,
yeah.
Well, there's a lot of great stuff we brought up here, but we're going to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking to Joshua Ramey, author of the new The Hermetic Deleuze, Philosophy and Spiritual Ordeal. And we'll be right back after these announcements.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis speaking with Joshua Ramey about philosophy and hermeticism and Deleuze and living without some of your organs. before the break, you were talking a little bit about his health and kind of how that influenced his work. Do you feel like, but he got attracted to some of that stuff before he was sick, is that right?
Oh, sure, yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what to you was kind of the biggest aha that you had in connecting him with some of the hermetic ideals and philosophies? Because that's really what I feel like your book will make some kind of groundbreaking stuff in, because a lot of people would never kind of affiliate him with that. Was there like a particular thing that you noticed when you were like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
yes and no. There was a slow convergence going on, and then there were some aha moments. And the convergence was that I had had what I thought was a sort of separate interest in and curiosity about Renaissance humanism, as I mentioned before, and Renaissance philosophy, and basically something in me, I had some intuition that after I started to read, two or three years into reading Deleuze and knowing I wanted to work on him, pushed me to sort of go back to look at the Renaissance, because I've just felt intuitively that there was some kind of connection. And the longer I worked on it, the more the connections became apparent to me. That there were complex ontologies here, at the center of which some kind of human agency was connected to the ability to transform reality, but in a way that wasn't immediately apparent and wasn't always available. This is what you have in for instance, Pico della Mirandola's oration on the dignity of man, which is sort of
right.
the most famous, you know, and widely read kind of manifesto of Renaissance thought. I mean, there Pico positions humanity, interestingly enough, not at the center of the universe, but actually outside and alongside everything else. He actually says that God said to Adam, Adam, I just created the world, but guess what? I filled it up. There's no room for you. So you're going to stand alongside the whole of the world and be able to traverse the cosmos and to occupy any of these places in accordance with your will. And there was a real aha moment there because Deleuze says something very similar in the cinema books about the way in which the camera and also the act of filmmaking puts humanity in a very similar position, and also the way in which Deleuze saw many artistic practices, including filmmaking, as a kind of holding a kind of promise of spiritual renewal and renewing what he called belief in the world, not belief that we would one day be rescued from this world, but that because of art we would see the world differently and thus see it for what it could be, and thus be inspired to remake it.
And that's very that's very anti-Gnostic, you know. So there he like kind of differentiates himself from a lot of those traditional ideologies.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to push on here is that, you know, another way of talking about immanence is that it's the opposite of transcendence. It's
right.
the idea that whatever you're seeking in the transcendent gesture is actually always already embedded in some fashion in the situation or experience or material world that you're in. And in a lot of ways, what he was doing was trying to figure out how do you think about an incorporeal or imperceptible realm that's sort of folded into this world, that doesn't stir the desire to flee matter or to flee the condition we're in.
Right.
And this sort of relates in a way almost even to that Renaissance notion you could say where it's not about resolving our situation but of recognizing that we're kind of restlessly moving through this situation that in some sense we demean by hoping to resolve with some kind of transcendental story or some kind of escape from matter or some kind of final answer or final sign that can resolve
right.
everything. And instead you have this thing that you call the sort of ordeal where you're sort of thrust back into the mystery of it. And I think particularly that you can have a kind of shamanic understanding in the loosest, you know, least anthropologically specific way of that,
yeah.
that using that term, in terms of a kind of affirmation of a world of not empty phantasms, but a world of transformations of both matter and what we would think of as mind, a kind of distributed world of entities and formations that we create alliances with, that you sort of move through this sort of, you know, difficult, tumultuous environment as a kind of passage, and that comes out a lot in his work. But what I really wanted to kind of press on you is against the tendency that a lot of people who are drawn to spirituality have to kind of resolve, to find the answer, to discover a kind of hook into transcendence, a way out, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
What is this other way about? What does this other way point to, this affirmation of belief in the world, this kind of transversal of ordeal?
Yeah, well, in the cinema books, Deleuze talked about this in terms of, you know, the almost a kind of a kind of fetishism of the shroud, that in cinema we're seeing the shroud of the world. The world is dying, the world is sick, the world is decayed, but we still have this kind of numinous, kind of almost undead, to use the Zizekian word, you know, stuff that's still malleable, that's still pliable, that can be rearranged, and it takes me back to Giordano Bruno, who I think is really the most sort of fascinating dark precursor to Deleuze, who in his own heretical way very heretical actually, held the theological doctrine that in creating the universe, God had he had fully diremptid himself. In other words, in creating the world, God became the world, so that such that the vicissitudes of this world, as Bruno called them, the ups and downs, the chaos, the strife, the disorder, as well as the joys and the ecstasy, that is God. That's what God has decided to become, as it were. So it's a sort of, you know, radical incarnationalism. So instead of God becoming fully this one human being, God has become everything for Bruno. And I think this is very much the way that Deleuze sees it as well. But Bruno has this really beautiful line in his treatise on magic where he says that, you know, there's nothing in this world that's been so marred or so tarnished or so damaged that it cannot yet become the seeds of the greatest transformations. And it's just a line that I come back to over and over again, and it's the idea that the most spiritual thing that we can do is not try to integrate the fragments back into some, you know, whole or some imagined whole, or return to some, you know, as Freud would put it, return to some womb of, you know, spiritual bliss, but rather to attend with our complete attention, to give ourselves over completely to the presence of the fragment, the presence of the thing, whatever that thing is, that is in our attention, that's in our field, literally. And this is, when Deleuze talks about immanence, I always think of it as this sort of spiritual space that opens up when that kind of attention, when that kind of care in a certain way, or when that kind of focus is elevated to a point where the entities involved start to enter into relations of communication and transformation and even play that wouldn't otherwise be possible.
Well, and that, I mean, I'm fascinated because and Bruno, really, that quote is so good, and Bruno saw the universe erotically, that because there are those negative, bad, sinful things, to him that wasn't like they weren't evil, it was part of the counteraction with that whole hermetic opposite idea, right? And that those were actually providing the friction for movement in order for you to access those places, and that the importance of concentration on those things was, like you said, that's what opened the veil or rendered the veil through that erotic friction that happened between the two things and caused it to move.
That's right.
I mean, in your pursuits of this, have you like kind of taken up any practices yourself in attempts to like attain any of that, or you just kind of get interested in the philosophy?
yes, I have. I my girlfriend calls me a religious lunatic,
and
I think I'm a little bit like Eric in this way, that, you know, I'll try everything twice, you know. I mean, the world has taken me to a lot of different places and a lot of different points on the map spiritually, but there are practices that I continue in there. I definitely feel very devoted to, and I would even say religiously obligated to a number of different traditions, actually. And I think one of the hardest things I've had to go through, I guess my own little ordeal, is how to somehow limit or organize the different modalities of practice and belief that I feel drawn to.
Right.
You know, I feel really drawn to a number of Native American practices, especially in the Lakota tradition of working with you know, with the animals, and working with the four directions, and working with ways of acknowledging the sacredness of place. I read the tarot fairly regularly. Divination is a major part of my life in one way or another. And to top it all off, I go to mass at an Anglo-Catholic church in Philadelphia, St. Mark's, where they put up with me. So. I practice yoga as much as I can. I've, you know, Some of the things I don't know if I want to that I've tried. I don't know if I want them to appear on a radio show, but the practice part of it is very important to me, and I think it's a huge part of the reason in the end why I wrote the book, because I can't practice philosophy without practicing spirituality.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think that what that points us to is also is another way to practice, or how do you practice with your practices. You know, it's like you can say, oh, this is, you know, Lakota's the way, or this is the way for me, or whatever, but it's also how you approach it, what you're looking for. And for me, it's often about noticing when I'm trying to, you know, solve the problem rather than cast insight or release something, you know. And am I doing this out of it? Is there an escapist element?
Yeah.
And even if there is, sometimes there is some kind of desire for, you know, there's different kinds of escapism. There's the kind where you want to just shut it off and not deal, and then there's the kind where you're drawn towards those experiences of intensity that you can understand in this philosophical language. But those experiences of intensity have a redemptive quality, not because they're pulling you out, but because they're deepening, you know, whatever it is, even the pain or the sadness or the melancholy or the frustration, that there's something behind that, a richer zone of it, an overtone of those experiences. And I think practices and the way in which you fall in and out of practices, and practices frustrate you and practices seduce you, that practicing with practice is a really key way of thinking through these things, but also evolving through them as well. But I'm curious, even what you've said is already extraordinarily heretical for a contemporary philosopher or professor of philosophy.
Well, I'm sure that it's part of the reason that I don't have a tenure track job yet, that's for sure.
And what's that about, man? When did that start? When was it so verboten, or not even verboten, because if you talk to people, you know, we all know people who are inside this world, write books anonymous wise, and you get them late night over the beer, and they're like, oh yeah, well, actually, I'm really interested in this, and this has been a big part of my life, and yes, I do tarot, or whatever, that just the way that these things are so marginalized, they're so frightening to the mainstream, or what, it's not even a mainstream, it's just they're so frightening to a certain idea or image of what philosophy is. What's going on there?
I've got a whole chapter in the book that tries to deal with this in one way called The Politics of Sorcery. It's a sixth chapter in the book, and that chapter opens with a section called Secular Anxieties from Freud to Adorno. And I try to start getting at this anxiety you're talking about, because it's everywhere. It's, you know, in my friends as well as my enemies. So what is that? I mean, that's a question that I'd really like to write about at more length one day when I can. But a lot of it has to do, I think, with the specific settlement of the Enlightenment between science and religion and the need to pretend to a certain paradigm of inquiry and objectivity and rationality within certain limits. I think always hear about Kant, you know, and his anxiety about the dreams of the spirit seer, and his anxieties about, you know, what lies on the hinter side of what can be validated in a kind of public and discursive way. And a lot of these experiences that we're talking about, they are self-validating. They come with a kind of certainty to them that's off-putting. It's funny. It's not so much that these practices issue in sort of ambivalent conclusions, and therefore we don't know what to say. It's that I think sometimes the results are just too clear, and we're not quite sure where to put that on a map, you know, made by skepticism.
Well, and I think that's an important part of it. It's because you know something and you can say it to someone, and then they get freaked out that you can know something so completely and so clearly, especially if it's something about them. And then they get upset, and that's the fear thing, where magic and sorcery has been treated as this fearful thing because someone can know it and then have power over you, right? But the stupid antidote to that is just teach it to everybody. And if everybody knows how to do magic, you don't have to be afraid of the sorcerers, because everybody's a sorcerer.
Yeah, exactly. And I try to push that kind of radically democratic ethos of, you know, the Hermetic tradition, And in conjunction with Deleuze's own, I think, highly utopian and even kind of eschatological sense of a people to come and a democracy to come that wouldn't be based on, you know, something as simple as representing, you know, as citizens, or something as you know, meager as protecting one another's rights, but that would be this much more intense mode of communication and interaction that it obviously is a long way off, or maybe it's closer than we think, but we have a certain kind of schizoid or paranoid relationship with it that it still needs a lot of investigation. I mean, there's so much history that's playing into it, not only in since the Enlightenment, but even since the early days of Christianity, with all the anxiety about paganism and the anxiety about the heresies and so on. All of those things are still with us as well.
Yeah, well, that gets back to, I think, a little bit of the way that Deleuze resonates with a certain kind of shamanic paradigm. And again, you know, he talks about this process of becoming animal, becoming imperceptible, becoming a sorcerer. He describes thought, as a sorcerer's flight. And there's this kind of sense of maybe even the more dark side of that shamanic worldview. But to me, that feels like it has something to do with this future vision of a politics to come, or a way of thinking with the earth that is not a return to balance. You know, so much of the spiritual and even kind of eco-based thought of how do you integrate human beings in this crazy civilization with a larger ecological frame. There's this emphasis on balance, on finding the sort of right sort of, you know, role for humans, and recognizing the kind of perfect harmony that reigns in nature. But there's other dimensions of nature too that are much wilder and freakier that you see in manifest in different ways anthropologically, in terms of how ecology becomes a way of an ecology of spirits as well as an ecology of material forces and
trees and of machines
animals.
As well.
Mm, and machines,
yeah.
As well. And so talk a little bit, he seems very significant for those of us who are groping towards some kind of a larger ecological thinking that is not driven by the idea of some perfect balance, but rather a different way of being and relating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think my friend Anthony Paul Smith has really written the most intelligent take on ecology somewhat coming out of Deleuze. You know, and hopefully his book will be in print fairly soon. But, you know, his idea is that, you know, nature is fundamentally perverse. You know, nature isn't this balanced, harmonious thing that is, you know, achieving or attempting to achieve homeostasis all over the place. It's something that is always going to one extreme or the other in ultimately sort of unpredictable ways. And that's a way into a much wilder ecology. You know, maybe even in, you know, this is the title of somebody's blog, I can't remember who, but it's an ecology without nature. I think it's Ben Woodard's blog, I think. But the Deleuze and Guattari's ecology is, unfortunately, at least on the surface of it, is not what contemporary environmental activists really want to work with. You know, I think that we do have to think about ecology in terms of a human, machine, animal, spiritual complex. I think thinkers like Graham Harman and Bruno Latour are also really helpful going in this direction, you know, pushing these thoughts forward. But, when you're thinking about all of the different forces that have to be accounted for and then evaluating them, you know, the first question for Deleuze and Guattari is not to figure out what's natural and what's cultural, you know, and so it's not even to sort of, if you're out of balance, if you have too much culture and not enough nature, you know, to kind of restore nature. The question really is about what are the intensities in the field and how are they relating and how are they ordered, and those intensities themselves maybe combinations of both natural and cultural, combinations of both machinic and spiritual. The true entities of the ecology might not even be recognizable to us yet.
Right. Well, that gets back to the first topic we were discussing, was how do you think interconnection of a kind of synthetic field that doesn't collapse into a single thing, into one thing. So it's the ecology is one thing. No, it's a weave. It's a weave where the differences that we normally draw between nature and culture, between technology and organic, perhaps don't really apply. But of course, it's very difficult to think about that world. It's very different to navigate through that world. And so, how do you think an encounter with Deleuzian thought, with Deleuzian practice, how do you think it helps one navigate, you know, thinking and being in our complex world today? Maybe, you know, even in practical ways, how it helps us avoid certain traps or opens up certain possibilities.
Well, I mean, practically, I think one of the most important things that can happen as one's reading Deleuze is that we can, if you're delighted enough by the world that's being described to you by Deleuze, I think that our affect toward, let's say, the threats to our individuality that appear to be out there, our affect toward those apparent threats, I think, starts to change. I think that you can potentially, you know, if you're seduced or lured a little bit into Deleuze's world, it you start to loosen up the grip that your own ego has on its habits, on its on maintaining what it's familiar with, and I think there's a kind of therapy there, similar to what I think you get out of reading Spinoza, in some ways, you know, where you begin to see yourself as not so much part of a larger whole, but you just begin to see life as being constantly translated and retranslated, made and unmade, in a process that you're ultimately much more a part of than a separate billiard ball within. And I think that's really, really important, right? In a globalized era, and you know, in an era also where, frankly, you know, there's all kinds of different levels of Holocaust going on all the time. Ecological, human, governmental. I mean, we in a lot of ways we're living through pretty terrifying times. I mean, one of the things I think that, you know, all of the spiritual traditions, the shamanic traditions especially, teach us to do is to become better friends with death. That we need to transform our relationship to our own dying, to the prospect of our own dying, and what that ultimately means in practice is a kind of relinquishing of the self and that leads on to the ability to take others as seriously as yourself, the ability to take potentially animals as seriously as humans, or to take a spirit or an intuition as seriously as an automobile or a computer.
Well, I think truly that speaks to Deleuze's shamanic abilities, that this comes from a man who was like facing death literally every day for like 25 years.
Yeah.
So it came, those realizations came out of this kind of broken man who was teeter-tottering between those two places and was able to somehow like get in that liminal space where he could see that web and those weaves, but only because he was so close to death and was able to open that world to maybe other people that weren't like in that crisis mode yet, but it was it's like the imminent crisis that, you know, is impending in all of us, and that he was able to have a vision into it and then relay it to everybody.
Well,
else.
We're going to have to end it there. I mean, I do think it is interesting that he was already doing that before he got sick, but it's that weird kind of way, like Nietzsche's sickness, where there's something really profound about it, even though it was also just a bum ride like so many of us. But we're going to have to wind it up there. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks to both of you as well. Thank you.
So check out Joshua Ramey's book, The Hermetic Deleuze. Give the man a shot. It's worthwhile. So from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.